In war-torn northeast Syria, refining oil is a cottage industry. It provides jobs and fuel, but also takes a toll on people and the environment.
You can see the oil fields from here, and then you have the sheep grazing right near these oil fields. The sheep don't look healthy at all.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also today, the U.S. is ready to finance an international security force for Haiti.
The people of Haiti need to decide their future, not gangs.
But the gangs are not backing down.
Plus, some good news today on global child mortality rates, and coral reefs produce lots of sound.
The reef is literally a wall of mouths.
That sound, it turns out, can be key to the health of those reefs.
Those stories and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us. We start today in Syria, a country that's been through 13 years of devastating conflict. Millions of people have been displaced, and about half the country's pre-war population is now living abroad. Inside Syria, according to the United Nations, more than half of those who've stayed suffer from hunger.
A lot of territory in the north of Syria is controlled by Kurdish or rebel forces. These areas have seen widespread damage to civilian infrastructure. They are also rich in oil. Many Syrians there have come to rely on makeshift refineries for fuel, but these facilities are not good for people's health or the environment. From northeast Syria, the world's Shirin Jafari reports.
It's a bright sunny day in March, and Shepherd Mahdin Ahmad al-Mahmoud is overseeing his flock of sheep. They're grazing on a green patch on the outskirts of Qamishli in northeastern Syria. Mahmoud is in his traditional red head wrap. His two kids are close by, keeping an eye on the animals. Mahmoud has grazed his sheep in this area for the past decade. He pulls out a picture of his son, which he carries in his pocket. Hamza was 23 years old when he was killed in a Turkish airstrike 2 years ago. Everyone here has been touched by the civil war in Syria in one way or another, he says. But in this seemingly idyllic landscape, bombs are not the only killers. Behind Muhammad, in the not-too-far distance, is a scene that could be out of a dystopian movie. A makeshift refinery where gas flares release toxic fumes and pipes spew black smoke into the air. Small pools of oil dot the pasture.
You can see the oil fields from here, and then you have the sheep grazing right near these oil fields. The sheep don't look healthy at all.
The older sheep's wool has turned black. There's an exhaustion in their eyes. Mahmoud insists his animals are healthy. He says they don't get too close to the refinery because of the awful smell. I'm wearing a respirator, and even I can smell the powerful chemicals. But Mahmoud says he's grateful for these refineries because they provide much-needed work for the people around here. I head over to the refinery to meet Abu Haydar Amal al-Shamri. He's one of the owners. 5 months ago, he partnered with five others to purchase a permit for this refinery. Shamri tells me he used to be a farmer. He planted wheat. For 4 or 5 years, we had droughts, he says. There was no rain, no water for the fields. So he explains he had no choice but to quit farming and to look for another job. The refinery produces about 200 barrels of fuel each day, Shamri says. Tankers fill up the fuel and transport it all across northeastern Syria. Some of the final product also makes it into government-held areas. The Kurdish administration owns the oil fields in this part of Syria, but for the refineries, it grants permits to private owners. Shamri says he paid $30,000 for his permit. He makes good money, he adds, but he doesn't specify how much exactly. Jawad Khalid Muhammad has worked here for the past 6 months. He says already he's noticed a difference in his health. He wakes up at night with a tightness in his chest. He gets frequent headaches and has difficulty breathing. Muhammad says he knows that his long-term health will be affected by this work, but he has no other options. Other workers describe feeling anxious and restless. Inhaling toxic fumes 10 hours a day takes its toll, they tell me. The environmental damage is visible at the Al Raad River, about half an hour's drive from the refinery. Blobs of black oil float in the muddy water. Downstream, sheep are drinking from the same river. Kawa Muhammad, an official from the Rumeyland Field Administration, says this oil spill is a result of a recent Turkish airstrike on oil fields and refineries in the area. Turkey sees the Kurdish administration here as a security threat and targets them regularly. It's going to take at least 1 year for this river to be completely cleaned up, Muhammad says. Then he repeats what others have told me. People around here rely on these old refineries for their livelihoods and for fuel. It's true that they cause a lot of pollution and health problems. But what other choice do we have? Muhammad says the Kurdish administration purchased new equipment to upgrade these refineries, but they've been stuck on the other side of the border in Iraq. Syria is under U.S. sanctions, and they can't get them through. So for now, people here pay a heavy price for fuel in their cars, to keep warm, and to turn on the light at night. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari, northeastern Syria.
Want to guess what this sound is? Maybe bacon sizzling or rain hitting a rooftop? It is actually the sound of a healthy coral reef. Lots of living things down there making noise. Scientists actually played recorded sounds like this for an underwater experiment in the Caribbean. They wanted to see how coral larvae might respond. Their work was published today in the Royal Society Open Science Journal. It shows that baby corals are attracted by the sound of a healthy coral reef and even settle in areas that have been losing their corals. Steve Simpson advised the research team. He's a professor at the University of Bristol in the UK. First off, Steve, can you describe what we are hearing in those underwater recordings?
The sounds of the coral reef are a pretty wonderful collection of vocalizations, the sounds of movement, the sounds of feeding that come from a complete carnival of life that is housed on a coral reef.
It is a fascinating sound. Can you describe what the researchers in the Caribbean did with these recordings of underwater sounds, how they found that it actually attracts coral larvae?
Well, first of all, when you visit a coral reef, you tend to be looking at juveniles and adults. But almost everything that lives on a coral reef has an early life stage, which doesn't live on a reef. In fact, it's a bit of a paradox as to why every animal that produces offspring sends its offspring into the deep blue. And that's probably a safe place to develop.
Yeah, the reefs just have too many predators, right?
They do. The reef is literally a wall of mouths when you're tiny. So it's a better place to develop out at sea. The challenge is you've got to find your way back. And what we realize is that through a whole variety of mechanisms, animals can detect the sound of a reef. So if you're a coral larva, you're about as simple an animal as you might imagine. You don't have a brain. You don't have ears.
Right.
And yet, bizarrely, you're finding your way back using sound. So what the researchers have done here is to explore then, if we know that coral larvae in this simple form are able to detect sound and move towards it, can it be used to try and improve the chances of those corals settling into habitats that we would love them to settle to, but they're no longer attracted to? And that's the sound of a degraded reef. A reef that might have been overfished, it might have been hit by a heat wave, so the corals have been killed, might have suffered historic sediment problems, but now that reef really isn't in a good state. If we add sound, by playing the sound back into the environment that we've recorded in healthy environments, does that sound change the likelihood of corals actually swimming down and wanting to settle into that environment? And that's exactly what they found, which is so exciting.
And how much of an effect did playing this sound have? How many more little baby corals were attracted to the degraded reefs?
Yeah, so across the experiment, it was nearly two times as many corals that were settling at sites where the researchers were adding the soundscape of a healthy reef. In some places, it was up to seven times, but it was, you know, a significant amount greater levels of settlement of these baby corals onto the substrate, onto the habitat, when they were adding the sound.
And does this study tell us anything about long-term reef regeneration? I mean, can we tell if any of these additional baby corals grew into adulthood and helped to revive a degraded reef?
So that's a good question. It will take some time to be able to monitor the growth of those larval corals. But when you consider that you've got very, very slim chance when a coral arrives on a reef of it being able to establish itself, find the right place to settle, and then grow into a colony, if you're doubling the amount of corals that are successfully settling, then you're really giving that reef a chance of recovering. You know, and I think when we talk about coral reef restoration, it's key that we develop these tools that maximize our success, maximize the chance of that coral reef being able to recover. Because we really are in a race against time with coral reefs to try and maintain as much biodiversity and as much health. And remember, the corals are they're the building blocks of the reef. They're the organisms that build the habitats that then host, you know, what is about a quarter of all known marine biodiversity. So it's really exciting that we're seeing that level of success at settlement. And then the exciting thing now will be watching those corals grow.
Steve Simpson at the University of Bristol in the UK explaining new research that could help restore coral reefs.
Staying in the water for this note, scientists say they're pinching themselves after discovering 100 new species of ocean life in a place called the Bounty Trough off the coast of New Zealand. In a three-week expedition, researchers from New Zealand, Australia, and the UK found everything from new fish to snails to corals to shrimp to sea cucumbers, and one creature that still has them baffled.
It's kind of a six-armed creature which has like little tentacles.
Sadie Mills is a marine biologist and was one of the co-leaders of the expedition.
We thought initially it might be an anemone-like creature, but since the anemone expert we emailed said that's not what it is, we're kind of back to the drawing board.
The Bounty Trough is nearly 16,000 feet below the ocean surface. That's almost as deep as the highest peak in the Alps is tall and largely uncharted, according to Mills.
And so we thought, wow, this is really cool. We've never been there before. We don't know what lives there. And although geologists have done some exploration of the mud and the rocks that are in the region, they've never looked at the animals before. So, yeah, that was to us really exciting to go and explore there.
90% of all ocean species remain unclassified. The nonprofit Ocean Census, which is the group behind the expedition, wants to find 100,000 new marine species in the next decade before overfishing and global warming drive some of them to extinction. The crew also tested out new ways of interacting with marine animals. For example, they attached glow strips to the bottom of an underwater camera to mimic the light from bioluminescent squid. The idea was to attract other glowing creatures, and it worked, much to the delight of Kat Bolstad, a cephalopod specialist, speaking here in a video recorded on the ship.
We had a large Tanningia danae squid, which is an animal that's over a meter long. It's got the largest light organs in the animal kingdom and hooks on all of the arms instead of suckers. So this large specimen swam through the frame, had a little look at us, flashed its light organs once, and then disappeared off into the darkness. And that was a heart-stopping moment.
Now that all these critters have been collected, they will be sent out to research labs for identification.
There's a whole world down there still waiting to be discovered.
You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Haiti, home to more than 11 million people, is seeing its worst violence and instability in decades. After Prime Minister Ariel Henry said he would resign, Haitian leaders are rushing to form a new government. U.S. and regional officials reportedly gave the country 24 hours to name a transitional council that will appoint a new prime minister. But the path ahead is far from clear. Vedant Patel is the principal deputy spokesperson for the U.S. State Department. He accompanied Secretary of State Antony Blinken Blinken when he met with Caribbean leaders in Jamaica this week.
To put it bluntly, the situation on the ground in Haiti is untenable. This is a priority for the Secretary of State, and we'll continue to be engaged through direct diplomacy, engaging partners on what we believe is the path forward. Over the past week, the Secretary has spoken to Prime Minister Henry a number of times. He spoke to President Ruto of Kenya a number of times. Kenya, which will be instrumental when it comes to the deployment of this multinational security support mission.
And what are U.S. diplomats insisting on for this transitional council to bring more stability to Haiti? What are the key ingredients?
We expect that the coalition of individuals that make up this presidential transitional council, those seven seats, that these various groups will take the next 24 to 48 hours and put a name forward of who their representative will be on this transition council. And one of their first actions of business is going to be selecting a new prime minister that can help keep a continuity of governance going, pave the way for a peaceful transitional power, get us to a pathway to free and fair elections down the line. But in the near term, help oversee the deployment of this multinational security support mission.
So the meetings where these decisions were made took place outside of Haiti, with CARICOM and the U.S. playing major roles. What is the international community doing to ensure that Haitians themselves will be able to drive this process forward?
Haitian stakeholders were very much part of Monday's deliberations. There were a significant number of Haitian stakeholders reflective of the diverse coalition interested in this. They had zoomed into the meeting and were engaging directly with CARICOM leaders and other international partners that had gathered.
Haiti's gangs effectively locked the prime minister out of the country, saying he must step down. And that's exactly what ended up happening. They're more powerful than ever. What is the plan for dealing with these groups going forward?
That is exactly why it is so critical that this path forward be a Haitian-led process and reflect the will of the Haitian people and Haitian stakeholders. The people of Haiti need to decide their future, not gangs. And that is why it was so key. And Secretary Blinken placed an immense emphasis on ensuring that the makeup of this presidential transitional committee would be reflective of the will of the Haitian people.
But if the gangs right now are wielding so much control, they have most of the capital under their control, you know, are they going to end up playing a role in the future government, either officially or in a de facto way?
The outcome statement that CARICOM put out at the conclusion of this meeting in Jamaica lays out pretty clearly what expectations are when it comes to who can participate in this presidential council or not.
The journalists we've been talking to who live in Haiti say that the outgoing Prime Minister Ariel Henry was ineffective and very unpopular, but he had the firm backing of the U.S. until this week. Why was the U.S. supporting Henry for so long?
For the longest time, our position had actually been one of that it was important that a transitional governance arrangement be made and steps be taken that include a continuity of governance, that included something like this presidential transition committee that was announced, and something that we hope that would get us to a pathway to free and fair elections and the appointment of a new prime minister. And things had reached an inflection point on the ground in Haiti. But ultimately, this is a decision for Prime Minister Henry, and this is a decision for the Haitian people.
I don't have to explain to you, of course, that when international actors come to Haiti, it has historically not ended well. They've in the past sparked a cholera epidemic and perpetrated sexual abuse. How can the international community address Haitian concerns that, you know, people from the outside might do more harm than good?
That is exactly why we feel so strongly that this process is a Haitian-led process. I mean, it's important to note that when it comes to the makeup of this presidential transitional council, that this be made up of Haitian stakeholders that reflect a diverse coalition, a coalition who have put their country above all their differences and all of their personal interests. That's what this is about.
I do want to spend a moment talking about Gaza. The U.S. military is building a temporary pier to bring humanitarian aid to the coast of Gaza by ship. Humanitarian groups say it would, of course, be far more effective for Israel to just open up more land routes into Gaza. Why isn't the U.S. using its leverage to get Israel to do more on humanitarian aid?
In every conversation with our Israeli partners, we have underscored the necessity that more can and must be done as it relates to the flow of humanitarian assistance. This has been part of every conversation we have had with our Israeli partners dating back to October 7th. And we believe at this point that we need to approach and use every lever at our disposal. We need to do everything we can, and we'll continue to have frank, tough, difficult conversations with partners when we think more needs to be done.
So if the U.S. has been pushing for increased aid since October 7th, as you say, or shortly thereafter, but now it is finding itself going around Israel to distribute aid via sea, is that a failure in U.S. diplomacy?
Not at all. And I would say that it has been U.S. diplomacy and engagement by this Secretary of State, Secretary Blinken, that has been a key and integral piece of unlocking avenues for the delivery of humanitarian aid. And that's something that we are going to continue to push for.
You say unlocking avenues for humanitarian aid, but so far none of those have required the cooperation of Israel. I mean, save a new shipment of aid that just went into the north of Gaza. So I'm struggling to see how that leverage has been effective when it comes to actually Israel providing aid or allowing for the most effective provision of aid.
You know, I respectfully disagree with that. And all of these avenues require cooperation with our Israeli partners, including, of course, delivery via land routes. And that's something that we are continuing to engage and coordinate with them on. Trucks are entering. Aid is flowing, certainly not at a clip or rate that is necessary, but it is happening. And we're going to continue to push around the clock and push everywhere we can to get more.
Is there a larger contradiction here in the U.S. arming the Israeli military on one hand, while on the other hand trying to aid civilians who can't get food or medical care because of how the war is being fought? Isn't U.S. policy working at cross purposes here?
We can have a multiplicity of goals and interests. We can have a goal that we share, in that the perpetrators of the October 7th terrorist attack should be held to account, and that Israel has every right to self-defense. It has right to security, and it has a right to ensure that Gaza can no longer be a springboard for terrorism. Simultaneously, we also have an immense conviction that everything must be done as possible to ensure that innocent Palestinian civilians are not caught in the crossfire, that everything possible is done to minimize civilian casualties. Both of those things can be true.
Vedant Patel is the principal deputy spokesperson for the U.S. State Department, explaining the U.S. position on Gaza and Haiti. You are listening to The World. Pashtana Durrani has spent much of her life trying to help girls in Afghanistan get an education.
Here's the thing. The way Afghanistan has always been seen is we are shown that, oh, we are the sort of people who don't believe in education. I needed to challenge that narrative, and I couldn't just wait for people to understand what I was trying to say.
The struggle to provide schooling to Afghan women, that's still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Alternative for Germany, or AfD as it's known, is a far-right political party with dozens of seats in Germany's national legislature. It's also suspected of being an extremist organization. That's according to Germany's own domestic intelligence agency. The AfD is fighting a court case against that extremist designation, a case that's being watched closely in Germany, as part of a wider discussion about the rising influence of this far-right party ahead of upcoming elections there. We asked Christopher Poskowski, a constitutional law expert at Bucerius Law School in Hamburg, to break down what this case against the AfD is all about.
This court case is about the Office for the Protection of the Constitution in Germany deciding to put the party under surveillance and put party members under surveillance. It is because the office saw concerns over alleged extremist elements within the party. And this is what the AfD is challenging now in the court of second instance. So we're at the appeal stage of this case.
So if Germany's own intelligence agency designates the AfD as a suspected extremist organization, what does that actually mean in practical terms if they're now surveilling them?
First and foremost, the office, which relies mostly on publicly available material, gathers party programs, speeches, statements made by party officials, and searches within all of this publicly available material for hints that could show that there are extremist elements and extremist tendencies within the party. However, if they're suspecting this, they can also use more intelligence methods, which might mean that they can call on informants within the party and talk to them.
I mean, at the same time, even though they have this extremist designation, they were elected, right? I mean, they are products of the German democracy.
That is actually one of the, I would say, most discussed political issues in this case is we have a non-bend party that a lot of people vote for. According to the last polls on the federal level, they would make up for around 17% of the votes. Or if we're looking at new state parliament elections this year, which are held in three states, they are the highest polling party. So putting them under surveillance is an issue for a lot of people with regard to the democratic process.
Well, despite members of AfD being elected to parliament, can you remind us why this party is seen as a threat in Germany?
They are a far-right populist party that, especially on issues like migration, is using very incendiary rhetoric. So a lot of people are concerned about the party overthrowing certain democratic institutions or attacking the courts when they come into political power.
There are certain political groups that are banned in Germany. Neo-Nazi groups are outlawed. What are the concerns about taking legal action against a political party like the AfD?
As I said, there are political concerns, of course, regarding a representative gap that would open up if the party is banned. So where do all these people go that are currently voting for the AfD? Legal scholars disagree on the chances of success here. Parties play an integral part in the German parliamentary process, and therefore requirements for banning them are very, very high. It entails a rigorous legal process where evidence of the party's unconstitutional activities must demonstrate a clear and present danger to the democratic order, and something the Constitutional Court calls potentiality. This means that there must be concrete evidence that makes it seem at least possible that the party's actions could be successful, as in the party's action to overthrow democratic institutions.
What else are people doing to counteract the growing power of the AfD?
People are taking to the streets, especially after a secret meeting held in Potsdam among extremists where the mass deportations were discussed, including of citizens from immigrant backgrounds. It is fair to say that this has properly shaken society and prompted mass demonstrations. So I would say there is a growing sensitivity among the general public about the risks if the AfD came into power.
Christopher, as a legal scholar, what interests you most about AfD's rise to power and this particular case?
This is a case that interests me a lot because it goes to the very core of what our democratic foundation and the Constitution wanted to achieve when they said that we need to fight against extremists. These cases don't come along very often, and this is a very highly politicized, as we're talking, I'm talking to a US radio station, worldwide known and seen case that, as I said, goes to the very core of what it means to live in a democracy in Europe.
Christopher Poskowski researches constitutional law at Bucerius Law School in Hamburg, Germany.
If you've seen images from pro-Palestinian demonstrations recently, especially in New York, you might have seen groups of Orthodox Jewish men there with long beards, black hats, and signs saying things like Judaism condemns the State of Israel and its atrocities. They're members of a group called Neturei Karta, a small minority of Orthodox Jews who are controversial, especially in Israel. Reporter Sarah Ventry in Jerusalem explains what the group is all about.
Mea Shearim is known for being one of the most religious neighborhoods in Jerusalem. And even for many locals, it's a whole other world. On the outside of a building is a worn Hebrew sign underneath a tangle of wires. It says, "To the ones passing through our neighborhood, we ask you in any possible way not to pass in our neighborhood wearing indecent clothes. Please do not disturb the holiness of our neighborhood and our way of living as Jews who are loyal to God and to his Torah." Mea Shearim is the home of Rabbi Shimon Roth.
Shmi Shimon Roth. Anachnu kan beYerushalayim.
My name is Shimon Roth. We are here in occupied Jerusalem, the original capital of Palestine.
Rabbi Roth is part of Neturei Karta, a Haredi sect. Haredi literally means trembling, as in trembling before God. Haredim are extremely religious and have a very strict commitment to Jewish law and custom. In fact, though this wouldn't be the case for all Haredim, Rabbi Roth only agreed to do the interview if I brought a male translator. Neturei Karta are best known for being anti-Zionist, meaning they are against the idea of a Jewish state of Israel, which is why they demonstrate alongside some unlikely allies in the streets of New York. But they're also in the streets of Jerusalem, in the state of Israel, which Neturei Karta believes shouldn't exist.
Today, the Zionist country had its regional election day. We do not take part in electing the fake sovereignty under the fake name of Israel.
Rabbi Roth says that part of living in Israel as an anti-Zionist means not voting or running for office, not taking assistance from the government, and openly supporting the return of all of Israel to Palestinians.
The Zionists say that they act on our behalf. They took the name Israel, which is not theirs to have. Our goal again is to express the natural opposition to the Zionists' crimes.
Normally, when we talk about Zionism, the movement that advocates for a Jewish state of Israel, we almost always talk about it in political terms. And for good reason. It's extremely political. But it can also be fundamentally religious.
I am starting to see signs in Yiddish. And I think this means I'm pretty close.
Back in New York, I'm on my way to the hamlet of Muncie, a little more than an hour outside of Manhattan, to meet Rabbi Yisrael David Weiss, a spokesman for Neturei Karta in the U.S.
Hi, Rabbi. Hi. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Come on in.
Thank you.
First, I should ask if you need a bathroom.
No, I'm good. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Rabbi Weiss answers the door wearing the exact same thing I've seen him wear in pictures, a white keffiyeh draped over a long black coat with a badge that reads, "A Jew, not a Zionist," pinned to the lapel. Attached to it is a picture of an Israeli flag covered by a red circle with a slash through it.
With the help of the Almighty, my name is Rabbi Yisrael David Weiss of Neturei Karta, International Jews United Against Zionism.
Rabbi Weiss is famously known for having visited Iran to speak at a conference about the Holocaust, alongside then-Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and former KKK leader David Duke, even though Rabbi Weiss says his grandparents died in the Holocaust.
Judaism is a covenant with God to uphold God's Torah, to be subservient to God. Zionism is a transformation to nationalism.
You've probably heard Zionists make the argument that God promised the land of Israel to the Jews. Rabbi Weiss and Neturei Karta understand things very differently.
It's a materialist concept to have a piece of land to be a nation like other nations. Totally contradictory to what Judaism is. That's the basics.
Those basics come from ancient history, specifically the time of the Second Temple in Jerusalem. That temple was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70, and many see this event as solidifying the Jewish diaspora.
We are expressly forbidden, since the destruction of the temple 2,000 years ago, God told us that we should not reestablish a Jewish sovereignty. The time when we made the covenant, God said we should go into the Holy Land and make a temple and be servant. But he warned us if we're not on that extremely high level of holiness, then we will be expelled from the Holy Land.
Neturei Karta go to great lengths in order to make this point, in ways that don't sit well with a lot of other Jews.
They don't just go to demonstrations. They deny Jews have a right to self-determination. They deny Jews have a right to self-govern, which is basically anti-Semitism.
This is Rabbi Yaakov Bierman. He's a public relations liaison for Chabad, a Haredi group headquartered in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. But he was very careful to say that he's speaking on his own behalf, because he says Chabad won't comment on other groups. But in his personal capacity?
They align themselves with Holocaust deniers. They align themselves with those that advocate for the destruction of the Jewish people. Their ideology lacks any religious or moral legitimacy.
So when Rabbi Weiss says that the Jews were expelled from the land that we now call Israel and that it doesn't belong to them, Rabbi Bierman says,
but they don't acknowledge that it's divine providence that gave that allowed Jews to create the state of Israel. The fact of the matter is the state exists, and the fact of the matter is that Jews worldwide are safer because of this state. And if something happens to the state of Israel, it's going to endanger Jews worldwide.
It's nationalism. It's nothing to do. It's void of God in its essence. They say you can be, it's a democracy. They call themselves a democracy.
This is Rabbi Weiss again. He says that Zionism is heresy.
They proudly announce that you don't have to be religious. They have gay rights parades in the middle of the center of Jerusalem. You don't have to eat kosher. You're a democracy. Judaism is not a democracy. It's a religion.
In Mea Shearim, religion is everything. In what is considered by many to be one of the holiest cities in the world, that also happens to be in the middle of what is now called Israel. I asked Rabbi Roth why he chooses to live here, given his beliefs about the state.
I used to walk with my grandfather in the old city of Jerusalem, and he used to tell me I lived here and here and here. As a child, he used to tell me the stories of his childhood from these streets, long before the Jewish state.
Today, Rabbi Roth and so many others look to those stories from the past, even if they have no agreement about the future. For the world, I'm Sarah Ventry in Jerusalem.
Across the globe, child mortality rates are stubbornly high. There is some good news, though, on that front from the United Nations. A new report says that the number of children who die before reaching the age of 5 declined to a record low in 2022. The report suggests there is still a lot of work to do on child mortality, but we wanted to know more about this decrease. Thomas Spurenberg is an officer in the Department of Economic and Social Affairs at the UN in New York.
As the report shows, we, for the first time, the world has less than 5 million under 5 mortality, or the number of children who died before their 5th birthday has reached a historic low, with 4.9 million in 2022. That's a good news. It's not a surprise because it's a decline that has happened over the last 20 or more years. And it's just a continuation of a trend that was set in motion over the past decades.
So is this improvement across the board globally, or is it isolated to kind of specific countries? And if that's the case, what's happening in those countries to turn around child mortality?
So it's across the world. We had some region and some country that have historically, because they come from higher mortality level. And currently, if you look at the world level and at the by region, the highest level of child mortality is found in sub-Saharan Africa, followed by Oceania, without Australia and New Zealand, and then Central and Southern Asia currently. So that's where we have also recorded the big drop from the year 2000. For example, in sub-Saharan Africa, under 5 mortality has divided by 2 from 2000, from 152 to 71 per 1,000 births. So this is a major achievement.
I did spot exemplary countries in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia, Malawi and Rwanda, Cambodia, Mongolia, where the decrease is really notable. One detail that stood out, the reliance on the work of midwives during childbirth. Can you help us understand how midwives have helped change the equation in places like Malawi and Cambodia?
It's very important that around the childbirth that we have a quality health care, and midwives are typically accessible in communities. So it's important to invest in their training, invest in the quality of training, invest to have sufficient midwife that can assist women during the delivery, because the number of deaths in the first 28 days of life, that's where we have the chunk of the under 5 mortality rate. Having women either visited by a midwife or having a healthcare that is in the community without a doctor, where midwife play a central role, and the woman and the child can benefit from this proximity and these community-based health services.
Yeah, and where the rates of child mortality are still high, you mentioned simple solutions that can be put into effect. What are the other kinds of things that are easily deployable?
Well, vaccination is another one, immunization, to make sure the kids receive their vaccines on time. Often it's not the case. We know also that child mortality is very high in settings where we have conflicts that exacerbate all this shortage of cares and medical infrastructure and so on. So these are critical for the birth and the health of the newly born.
What are the goals that the UN has set out to address the issue of child mortality? I mean, I assume zero deaths, but we know that's probably unrealistic.
The goal is to have as low as possible child mortality. One thing to do is that we are talking about number in this report showcase new set of estimates. Behind all these estimates, there are data. So there's also need to invest into data collection, into estimation. And elsewhere, we hope that further developing and investing, and that's important, we should keep investing in those healthcare in the community and midwife. And we mentioned midwife. This is important to continue investing in and not rest on the success that we have made, but make sure that everywhere, every child that is born has the same right and also the same access to medical care.
That was Thomas Spurenberg with the UN's Department of Economic and Social Affairs.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Afghanistan, girls are the last to eat, last to learn. That is the title of a new book by Pashana Durrani about her work to educate girls and women in Afghanistan. Durrani grew up in an Afghan refugee camp in Pakistan in a family that valued education. She worked as a teacher for girls in Afghanistan after the U.S.-led invasion in 2001 and the toppling of the Taliban. She's now living in the U.S. and spoke recently with The World Carol Hills about why she focuses on using technology with her students.
Here's the thing. The way Afghanistan has always been seen is we are shown that, oh, we are the sort of people who don't believe in education. I needed to challenge that narrative, and I couldn't just wait for people to understand what I was trying to say. For me, the easier way was to, okay, communities in rural tribal regions that are seen as the people who are nice to Taliban. I am from those regions, so I'm going to talk to them and I'm going to work with them. And then I'm going to bring in resources that's going to teach us within our own homes without us waiting for somebody to come and build schools for us, you know, for some nonprofit or for some international organization to take a pity on us or our region and build schools for us. So for me, it was very important to start right away and sort of prove it, but also in a very practical way where I'm not just being philosophical about it, but I'm mostly telling them that this is the reality, the ground reality. And if we couldn't, it was really simple. If we couldn't just walk to school, the schools had to walk to us. And that's how we did it. Yeah.
Pashtana, take us through a typical day when you were teaching young girls in Afghanistan. What was it?
A typical day would consist of me waking up, getting ready for school and an office, honestly. And then after that, we would have our staff meetings. After staff meetings, me and my coworkers would head up to the Malalai School, which was one of the schools that we were working with. I was the main lead for that school. So we would head up to those schools, and then the girls would be done with some of their schooling and classes, and we would teach them like different subjects that came under our area, which was mainly sciences, but also like different skills that we would teach them. And we would lead workshops like menstrual hygiene management and all of that. And post that, after 2-3 p.m., once they were done, we were done with their sessions and everything, we would head back to office and then do a reflection meeting and focus group meetings with other teachers and finalize everything. And then this was what we did all day, every day when we were back in Afghanistan. Yeah.
Now, U.S. troops pulled out of Afghanistan in August 2021. It was really abrupt. It was chaotic. And you were one of the thousands who got caught up in it. You had to leave. How quickly did you have to pack up and leave the country?
I mean, when the whole thing happened, I didn't necessarily think I was going to leave because I already had a U.S. visa. I had a DS-160, so I could have left any moment I wanted. The only thing that kept me until I was there was because I thought this cannot be the end. Like, the world cannot just turn a blind eye on this. Like, they cannot do this to us for the second time. But it took me a good 1 month to realize that people really don't care about us. Like, they just wanted to wash their hands off of us, and that's it. And it was a different effort. Like, there are things that I cannot even say it openly because the people involved were active duty people who helped me out. But it took us a very long time to get to where I am today. Yeah.
What about your students in Afghanistan? What's happened to them?
We still have active schools. The one thing that we did after the Taliban took over was like reestablish our first school, and now we have like three schools and they still get educated. Yes, we don't have 7,000 students like we had in the past, but at least now we have retained a good number of 300 girls who still get to get educated.
But how is that working? I thought the Taliban really cracked down on girls getting an education.
Sure, but like that's the whole point. Like, that's how it's seen. But then again, yes, the Taliban have their own power. But then again, we have our own community connections. We have our own people. And it's all of it is done underground. So the schools that we have are like underground. Some of them are in basements. Some of them are in hospitals. Some of them are in somebody's guest house. So it's not an open public school that you can just walk up to. It has to be an underground network that tells you somebody that, oh, there's a school that is doing this. And you're only allowed to get access to that location if you have, like, you know, pass the security test and everything. Yeah.
That's very interesting. So it's all sort of below boards.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's very poignant because, once again, you're living outside Afghanistan. You're overseeing the NGO you founded from a distance. And inside Afghanistan, the Taliban are back in control, imposing all kinds of restrictions on what women and young girls can and cannot do. How involved are you now with teaching young girls still in Afghanistan? How do you manage it given the distance?
There are times where I have to take calls in the middle of the night. I mean, I have a call on Monday that's at 5:30 in the morning. There are times, yes, I have to navigate all of those. I have a team that is like around 40 members team that oversees all the curriculum, all the planning, all the teacher training and all of that. And then on my end, I do most of the fundraising. I do a lot of leadership decision making. And then at the same time, I talk to students and teachers on weekly and monthly basis to ensure that we are on top of everything, and we continue to provide them all the lessons and everything. But I think I'm more in a leadership role now than I was back in the day. I talk to them, but I don't teach necessarily the way I used to teach back in the day.
Pashtana Durrani is founder of the NGO Learn and co-author of the book Last to Eat, Last to Learn: My Life in Afghanistan, Fighting to Educate Women. She spoke to the World's Carol Hills from Wellesley, Massachusetts.
We end where we began this hour, in the Mideast, with a story of a man determined not to let the modern world eclipse the past. Zakaria Ibrahim, known as El Reyes, or The Boss, the founder of the legendary Egyptian musical ensemble El Tambura. He died last month. The group hailed from Port Said, a sleepy town, until construction began on the Suez Canal in the mid-1800s. Workers came from across Egypt to build it and brought music with them, including a style of love song that would be performed in the street, accompanied by an instrument called the simsimia. Over time, the driving rhythm influenced newer, more modern music, which would end up dominating Egyptian pop. Zakaria Ibrahim saw that the modern was killing the original form of the music, so he founded El Tambura to keep it alive. He explained his challenge at the El Mastaba Center in Port Said back in 2006. Do I surrender to the way things have become, he wondered, or do I attempt to bring back the old folks to sing again, encouraging the younger generation to learn and sing the old songs? Today, the multi-generational El Tambura Ensemble is a legacy that continues without him. Zakaria Ibrahim was 72.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.